This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Shaud Kutin, with me Tan Chung Han. Time for the business stories that are in making headlines and shaping our world. We have the TPP, whether it's going to go ahead or not. We also have China's relations with both the Philippines and the Singapore in our mix. Very quickly, Han, we have a Twitter poll that's about whether our relationship to China can be a win-win, as argued by UMNO's youth leader, Shaul Hamdan. You can join that poll. There's a yes, no, and I don't know enough option on that poll. Already we have the vast majority of people saying they don't know enough. And to help us understand more, we have on the line Elena Noh. She's the Director of Foreign Policy and Security Studies at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies. Good morning, Elena.
Good morning,
Sharad. Good morning, Alina. Han here. So now, over the weekend, we had those headlines involving ASEAN countries, you know, Malaysia, Singapore, Vietnam, Brunei, among the 11 TPP countries who have agreed to go ahead with that trade deal without the US. So start us off by reminding us, you know, how substantial is a TPP without the US?
Hi, Han. Yes, the TPP, the U.S. was meant to be the linchpin of the TPP. But with the U.S.'s withdrawal of the TPP, there's still a lot of keenness and interest among the 11 countries to go ahead with some sort of variation of the arrangement as was previously negotiated. Obviously, the U.S. was supposed to have comprised the largest component, the most important and strategic component of the TPP. But I think because there's been a lot of commitments by the 11 other trading nations and who've seen the benefits of going ahead with some sort of a TPP-11, you'll see that I think what we can expect is that this TPP is going to go ahead with more of a focus on the parts that don't perhaps include the U.S. directly. It's also important to recall that a TPP without the U.S. is also significant for the U.S. because, as I said, the TPP was supposed to be a strategic arrangement for the U.S. in the Asia-Pacific. And the U.S.'s withdrawal not only impacted its credibility in this region because there was so much domestic political capital that was expended among the other trading nations in trying to get the TPP forward, and the U.S. was seen to have been sort of the main driver of the TPP, it was not only the U.S.'s credibility that was impacted, but the U.S.'s withdrawal also, I think, will result in some sort of strategic void of leadership for the U.S. itself in this region. So it's pretty substantial and significant that the other trading nations in the TPP have decided to just go ahead and commit themselves to some sort of iteration of the TPP, even without the U.S.
Sharad here, Elena. The question, of course, is, you know, you talked about withdrawal, you talk about void, and naturally we think of a vacuum and, you know, China filling that. But when it comes to the real economy, I mean, apart from the kind of aspirational statements that are made by politicians, America is still big, isn't it? Isn't it huge for all these economies in terms of where they export? That hasn't really changed as a fact on the ground, has it?
No, it hasn't. But, you know, the TPP, as we all remember, was supposed to be more than just economics. It was supposed to be a gold standard arrangement for rules of the road going forward that were also supposed to impact, you know, traditionally non-economic areas like labor, the environment, and intellectual property, for example. So it was more than just economics. And the U.S. being out of the TPP now, I think it's a real loss for the U.S. itself because it negotiated so many of these future-setting rules for the region. And so, it's significant that the other 11 nations have said, look, we're committing to this and we're going to go ahead. Now, having said that, it's still the early stages because the ministers will, of course, need to have further discussions, and we'll find out a little more later on when the ministers meet again in November.
Now, so in talking about who's going to fill that void left by the U.S., you know, so often in our conversation, China is often mentioned, right? Yet, over the weekend, we got comments, you know, that apparently, according to Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, China had threatened war with the Philippines if they drill for oil in the South China Sea. You know, real quick, what are you reading into these comments?
First of all, we haven't heard any response from China yet. So all this has just been coming up from President Duterte, and he's a very controversial figure, as we all know. Now, assuming his remarks are true, I think this really showcases the dilemma that many countries, and particularly the Southeast Asian disputants, face in Southeast Asia. We all want to be friends with China because it's such an economic, diplomatic, and political might, and it's the closest neighbor in terms of major powers in this region for us. But at the same time, because we have overlapping claims in the South China Sea, and precisely because of China's military, political, and diplomatic might, smaller Southeast Asian countries realize that it cannot go head-to-head or toe-to-toe with China. And so I think President Duterte's claims really emphasizes this dilemma that many countries in Southeast Asia face. Economic benefits with China as a huge trading partner, investment partner, but also very difficult choices that may need to be made in the future if China decides to step up its muscular approach to its strategic interests in this region.
You know, one of the arguments that I'm going to be referring to a poll that we have, and I hope you will join it if you haven't already, which is whether, you know, Malaysia and China can be in a win-win situation over China's Belt and Road project. Now, the question of China's political ambitions, and there's an assertion made by Cheryl Hamdan, who wrote this letter to The Star, that in fact, that China is less imperious. And do we actually have evidence of that? Is China less imperious, you think?
Well, it depends how far back in history we want to stretch, right? I think countries like Vietnam and others may have a different view of China. But certainly in recent times, we haven't seen some of that arrogant imperiousness in the same vein as we've seen with past colonial powers, for example. But that's not to say that history is going to be a straight line trajectory, and you could see some changes moving forward. So it's basically left to the open how China will act in the future. I think what all countries in Southeast Asia must necessarily do because of their relative size to China is take a positive and optimistic view of China. Because at this point in time, there's just no point in trying to anger China, and all countries want to extract as much benefits from each other as possible.
Now, Alina, while you say that, you know, ASEAN countries must take that positive view and, you know, try not to anger China, yet you have got Singapore, who appears to be doing the opposite. You know, and so, you know, there's media reports about them possibly risking out on billions of dollars investments from that One Belt, One Road summit, right? So, you know, like, how viable is Singapore's attempts to push back against this might of China?
Alina, before you jump in and answer Han's question, I think it just to say that I don't think Singapore sought to anger China. In fact, right, what it was Chinese...
They risked it.
They risked it by being neutral on the South China Sea. Correct me if I'm wrong, Alina. Was it Singapore's refusal to take China's side in this dispute that led to all that vitriol against Singapore?
I mean, certainly some analysts have said that it was Singapore's quote-unquote independent position on issues like the South China Sea that have piqued China and irritated it slightly. You've also heard Chinese analysts based in China saying China did not think too much of Singapore's position to pick China for its economic benefits and the U.S. for its strategic and military benefits, for example. So in a sense, I think Singapore's attempt to be neutral, to be independent as a strong, tiny nation in Southeast Asia has unfortunately put it in a very difficult position. You've seen that Singapore has borne the brunt of a lot of China's irritation recently with the seizure of its Terex vehicles, for example, late last year, and with the latest, as you pointed out, this non-invitation to the BRI conference recently. But Singaporeans will tell you that this is not new. They've weathered this many times over, and this will be just another phase for them to get over with China. Now, whether or not they can afford to continue with this independence, so to speak, moving forward is something Singaporeans will have to decide for themselves. But certainly it makes them look good image-wise in the eyes of the world when outside observers, particularly in the West, see more and more countries in this region as turning towards China. I don't think that's completely right. But Singapore's image, its credibility is certainly now in question domestically as well as internationally.
I just want to, Elena, are you going to join our Twitter poll? That's the most important question this morning that I need you to answer.
Right, I'll succumb to pressure and I will join the Twitter poll.
Thank you very much. That was Elena Noor, Director of Foreign Policy and Security Studies at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies in Malaysia. We'll be back with more business news, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.